Now I, Paul, myself plead with you by the mildness and kindness of Christ, I who in your presence am humble among you, but being away am brave toward you. Yes, I implore you that I may not, when present, show bravery with the confidence with which I plan to be bold against some, who think of us as if we behave according to human nature. After completing his discourse on almsgiving, demonstrating that he loves them more than they love him, and recounting his patience and trials, he now timely touches on criticisms, alluding to the false apostles, and concluding his discourse with less pleasant matters and praising himself, for he often does this throughout the epistle. Being aware of this, he often corrects himself, saying straightforwardly, "Are we starting to praise ourselves again?" And later on, "We are not praising ourselves again, but giving you a reason to boast." And afterwards, "I have become a fool in boasting. You have forced me." And he uses many such corrections. And it wouldn't be incorrect to call this epistle a praise of Paul. He mentions his grace and patience abundantly. For since there were some among them who thought highly of themselves, who thought they were superior to the apostle, and accused him of boasting and being worthless, and of teaching unsound doctrine, look at how he starts his criticism of them. "Now I, Paul myself, do you see the sternness, the dignity here?" For he is saying, "I urge you, don't force me, don't make me use my power against those who disregard us and consider us as ordinary." This is harsher than the threats he made in the previous epistle, "Shall I come to you with a rod, or with love and a gentle spirit?" And then again, "Now some are overconfident as if I were not coming to you, but I will come and will not just hear the words of those who are overconfident, but their power." For he demonstrates both his power and his patience and tolerance. He pleads with them so earnestly so that he isn't forced to display his punitive power, to strike them down and punish them severely. For he implied this in saying, "But I urge you that I may not, when present, show courage with the confidence where I intend to be brave against those who consider us as if we lived according to worldly standards. For now, however, let's focus on the beginning. Now I, Paul myself." Great emphasis, great weight is here. So too, he says elsewhere, "Look, I, Paul, am telling you," and again, "as Paul the elder," and again in another place, "who has cared for many and for me as well." So also here, "Now I, Paul myself." The mere fact that he himself is pleading is significant, but the added phrase, "by the meekness and gentleness of Christ," is even more meaningful. Hoping to greatly shame them, he emphasizes that meekness and gentleness, making his plea even more powerful, as if he had said, "Respect the gentleness of Christ with which I am pleading with you." And he said this while also indicating that should they impose any serious necessity upon him, he himself is more inclined to meekness. It is because of his gentleness, not lack of power, that he does not confront them, for Christ also did in a similar way. "Who in your presence am humble among you, but being absent am confident toward you." What, please, is this? Surely he speaks in sarcasm using their words, for they said this, that when he is present indeed, he is insignificant but poor and contemptible, but when absent, puffs up and boasts and positions himself against us and threatens. This at least he implies also afterwards, saying, "For his letters, they say, are weighty, but his physical presence is weak, and his speech is insignificant." He either then speaks in sarcasm, showing great severity, and saying, "I the base, I the low, when present and when absent, lofty," or else meaning that even though he should utter great things, it is not out of arrogance, but out of his confidence in them. "But I urge you that I may not have to show courage with the confidence that I intend to show when I stand up against those who think that we live in accordance to worldly desires." Do you see his strong disapproval and thorough dismissal of their accusations? For he says, "I urge you not to force me to demonstrate that even in person I possess strength and authority, for since they claim that when he is not with us, he bravely takes a stand against us and exalts himself." He relies on their very words. "I therefore urge them not to make me exercise my authority." That's what the confidence means. And he didn't say, "with which I am prepared," but "with which I intend." "For I have not yet decided on this. They certainly give me plenty of reasons, but I still don't want it." And yet he was doing this not for self-defense, but for the gospel. Now, if he isn't harsh where he needs to stand up for the message, but rather steps back and waits, begging that it shouldn't become necessary, it's even more unlikely that he would ever do so in his own defense. "Grant me this favor," he says, "that you don't force me to demonstrate that even in person I am capable of standing up against whoever it might be necessary, that is, to discipline and punish them." Do you see how humble he was? How he did nothing for show, since even when it was absolutely necessary, he doesn't hesitate to refer to the act as bold. "For I urge you," he says, "that I may not have to show courage with the confidence that I intend to be bold against some. This indeed is the sign of a teacher not being hasty in meting out punishment, but aiming for a change and always being reluctant and slow to punish." So how does he define those whom he threatens? Those who regard us as if we live according to worldly desires, for they were accusing him of being deceitful, wicked, and boastful. Verse 3. Even though we live in the flesh, we do not battle following the ways of the flesh. He continues to warn them, using the metaphor he employs, for, he says, "We are indeed surrounded by flesh. I acknowledge it, but we do not live by the flesh." Or rather, he didn't even say this, but holds it back for now as it's part of the praise for his life. But first he talks about the preaching, and demonstrates that it doesn't come from man, nor does it need support from below. That's why he didn't say, "We do not live according to the flesh." Instead he said, "We do not fight according to the flesh," meaning, we have taken on a war and a struggle. But we don't fight with carnal weapons, nor with the help of any human resources. For our weapons are not physical. What kind of weapons are of the flesh? Wealth, glory, power, fluency, cleverness, circumventions, flatteries, hypocrisies, and anything else that is similar to these. But ours are not like this. So what kind are they? Powerful in the sight of God. And he didn't say we are not earthly, but our weapons. As I said, for now he discusses the preaching and attributes all power to God. And he doesn't say spiritual, even though this would be the opposite to earthly, but mighty, implying both and demonstrating that their weapons are weak and powerless. And notice his lack of arrogance. He didn't say, "We are powerful," but "Our weapons are powerful in God's presence." We didn't make them powerful, but God himself did. Because they were abused, persecuted, and suffered countless incurable wrongs, which were signs of weakness, he shows God's strength by saying, "But they are powerful before God." This particularly displays his strength, that he secures victory through these things. So even if we are surrounded by them, yet it's him who battles and works through them. Then he praises them at length, saying, "By the dismantling of strongholds." And in case the mention of strongholds makes you think of anything physical, he states, Verse 5, tearing down imaginations. First emphasizing through metaphor, then by this added expression revealing the spiritual nature of the battle. For these strongholds besiege souls, not bodies. Therefore they are stronger than the others, and hence they also require mightier weapons. But by strongholds he refers to the Grecian arrogance, their sophistical arguments, and their logical reasoning. Yet still, these weapons, he states, overwhelm everything that opposed them, for they overthrow imaginations and every high thing that is raised against the knowledge of God. He continued using the metaphor to enhance the emphasis. For even if there are strongholds, he says, even fortifications, even anything else whatsoever, they surrender and retreat before these weapons, and making every thought submit to the obedience of Christ. The term captivity typically has a negative connotation. It implies the termination of freedom. Then why did he use it? For its particular significance related to another aspect. The term captivity conveys two meanings: the loss of freedom and being so forcefully suppressed that one cannot rebound. He chose it for this second implication. Similar to when he states, "I robbed other churches," he doesn't mean taking covertly, but stripping and taking everything. Same goes for bringing into captivity. The battle wasn't equal. He triumphed with ease. So he didn't merely say, "We win and are superior," but "We even bring into captivity." Just as he earlier didn't say, "We forcibly oppose the strongholds," but "We overthrow them, for the supremacy of our weapons is immense." Our conflict isn't with words, he says, but with actions against words, not with human wisdom, but with a gentle and powerful spirit. How then, as they accused him, saying, his letters are weighty, should I pursue prestige, boast in words and menacingly write letters, when our strength doesn't lie in these things? But having said, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, because of the unpleasantness of captivity, he swiftly brought an end to the analogy, saying, unto the obedience of Christ, from bondage to liberty, from death to life, from ruin to salvation. We aim not only to topple, but also to convert to the truth those who oppose us. Verse 6, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is complete. He sent out a warning to these individuals as well, not just to those alone. For he says, we were waiting for you, so that through our teachings and warnings we could reform you and separate you from their company. Then, when only those who are beyond help are left, we can punish them after we see that you've truly distanced from them. Because right now, you do obey, but not entirely. And yet, if you had acted now, someone says, you would have accomplished more. Not at all, because if I had done it now, I would have included you in the punishment. However, we needed to punish them, indeed, but to spare you. Although if I had spared them, I would have seemed to be doing it out of favor. But what I really want is to improve you first, and then to take action against them. What heart could be more tender than the apostle's? He desired to land the blow, but refrained, holding back his anger until these individuals had pulled away so that he could strike only them, although not even them, actually. He threatened this and claimed he wished to only punish them so that they too might change out of fear and he wouldn't have to vent his anger on anyone. Just like a very skilled doctor, a common father, a guardian and protector, he did everything. Looking out for everyone, removing obstacles, stopping those spreading harm, rushing about everywhere. For he did not accomplish his mission through conflict, but rather, as if he was approaching a simple and easy victory, he erected his monuments of victory, undermining, pulling down, demolishing the defenses and strategies of the devil and the demons, directing all the spoils of war toward Christ's camp. He didn't even pause for a breather, leaping from one group to the next, and from them to others, acting like a very talented general and raising victory monuments every day or even every hour. For armed with nothing more than a humble tunic, the excellency of Paul's speech allowed him to capture his enemies' cities along with their warriors and weapons of bows, spears, and darts. For he spoke only, and attacking his enemies more fiercely than any fire, his words drove out the demons and converted the men who were possessed by them. For when he exorcised that demon, the evil one, 50,000 sorcerers united and burned their magic books, turning to the truth. And just as in a war, when a tower has fallen or a tyrant has been overthrown, all his supporters discard their weapons and rush to the enemy general. So it truly happened then also. For when the demon was expelled, all of them under siege and having discarded or rather destroyed their books, ran to Paul's feet. But he, standing against the world as though against a single army, never halted his progress, but accomplished all things as if he were a man gifted with wings, one moment healing a lame person, the next raising a dead man and then blinding another. He wouldn't rest even when confined in a prison, converting even the jailer there, achieving the noble captivity we discuss. Let's also strive to emulate him to the best of our abilities. Why do I say to the best of our abilities? Because anyone who wishes can approach him, marvel at his courage, and emulate his bravery. He continues to do his work, throwing down arrogant thoughts and everything else that uplifts itself against the knowledge of God. Many heretics have tried to divide him, yet even when fragmented, he asserts a powerful strength. Marcion and Manichaeus exploit him, but only after dissecting him. Still, even so, they are confuted by separate parts. A mere hand of this warrior, caught among them, defeats them completely. A mere foot left among others chases and overthrows them. This teaches you the excessive extent of his power. Even when his limbs are detached, he can still destroy all his opponents. But, says one, doesn't it pervert the truth when those opposing each other all cite him? It indeed perverts the truth, but not in Paul, but in those who exploit him. Paul was not multicolored, but uniform and clear, but they twisted his words to fit their own interpretations. Why, says one, were his words expressed in such a way to provide ammunition to those seeking it? Paul didn't provide the ammunition, rather their madness misappropriated his words, since the whole world is both magnificent and vast, a sure testament to God's wisdom, with the heavens proclaiming the glory of God, and day unto day pours forth speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. But still, many have been misguided by it in opposing directions. Some have deified it extravagantly, resulting in thinking it as God, while others have been so oblivious of its beauty as to allege it's unworthy of God's creation, attributing most of it to an evil substance. Yet God preempted both points by making the world beautiful and grand, that it might not be thought alien to his wisdom, yet incomplete and not self-sufficient, that it might not be misconceived as God. Yet those blinded by their rationale fell into opposing beliefs, refuting each other, indicting their other's understanding, and thus upholding God's wisdom even by the arguments that led them astray. Why mention the sun and the sky? The Jews saw so many miracles, yet almost immediately worshipped a calf. They saw Christ casting out demons, yet they labeled him as possessed. But such was not an insult against the one expelling the demons, but rather an indictment of their understanding who was so blinded. Hence, do not berate Paul on account of the judgment of those who have misused him, but instead comprehend the treasures in him, unfolding his riches, and you will be able to stand firm against all clad in his armor. Such will silence both Greeks and Jews alike. But how, says one, seeing they do not accept him, through the works performed through him, by the transformation changed in the world? It wasn't human power to accomplish such great deeds, but the might of the crucified, inspiring him, made him as he was, and rendered him more influential than speakers, thinkers, kings, and all men. He not only could equip himself and vanquish his enemies, but also transform others into being like himself. Therefore, so we may become beneficial both to ourselves and to others, let's constantly have him by our side, turning to his writings as a meadow and garden filled with delight. Thus, we shall be capable of avoiding vice, choosing virtue, and obtaining the promised good things, and may we all attain to this through the grace and love towards men of our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom, with the Father and the Holy Spirit, be glory, power, honor, both now and forever, and unto ages of ages. Amen.